A heavy, driving rain falls on a freshly plowed field in northern France. It is October 25th, 1415. The armored elite of Europe, you know, men who have spent their entire lives training for martial supremacy, they are suffocating in thick, freezing mud.
Right. They're packed so tightly together they cannot even lift their arms to swing their sword.
And they're being slaughtered at close range, not by rival lords in a glorious chivalric duel, but by exhausted, half-starved English peasants wielding wooden mallets, axes, and daggers. Welcome to the History Maps podcast.
Our mission for this deep dive into the sources is to unpack the sheer scale, the complexity, and the brutal reality of the struggle between England and France. The struggle that culminated in moments like that muddy slaughter at Agincourt. We are looking at the Hundred Years' War.
But we need to clear up the most immediate misconceptions right away, because it was not a single continuous war, and it certainly did not last for exactly 100 years.
No, not at all. What the sources actually describe is an intermittent, grueling series of conflicts spanning 116 years, from 1337 to 1453.
Exactly. And for you, the listener, understanding this era is absolutely crucial if you are studying how medieval feudalism, with its armored knights, stone castles, and highly decentralized local power, transitioned into the centralized states of early modern Europe that we recognize today.
Yeah, this conflict was the painful crucible that forged the modern administrative state. But to understand a structural shift of that magnitude and a war that spans over a century, we really have to set up the board. We have to look at the spark that lit the powder keg.
Right. We are looking at a severe crisis of succession, deeply intertwined with a massive dispute over fertile, economically vital land.
Let's trace this dynastic crisis, starting with the catastrophic failure of the French Capetian dynasty. King Philip IV dies in 1314, and he leaves behind three healthy sons.
Which, in the medieval political framework, usually secures a dynasty for generations. I mean, you have an heir and two spares.
You do. But one by one, those sons take the throne, and one by one, they die without leaving a surviving male heir. First Louis X, then Philip V, and finally Charles IV, who dies in 1328.
And when Charles IV died, his queen was pregnant, right?
Yes. But she delivered a stillborn daughter. So this extinguished the senior Capetian branch entirely. France faced a terrifying vacuum of power. The French nobility immediately assembled in Paris to figure out who should wear the crown.
Because a kingdom without a recognized monarch was vulnerable to immediate collapse.
Precisely. And they had a very prominent candidate sitting right across the English Channel, King Edward III of England.
Right, because he was the grandson of Philip IV through his mother Isabella, and Isabella was the sister of those three dead kings.
Exactly. So by proximity of blood, just simply looking at a family tree, Edward III seemed to have an incredibly strong direct claim to the French throne.
He did, but the French nobility were entirely opposed to the idea of an English king ruling France. To block Edward, they invoked the Lex Salica, or Salic Law.
Yeah, this was an ancient Frankish civil code that they essentially dusted off and reinterpreted. They used it to assert that women could not inherit land, and more importantly, succession could not be traced through a female line.
Wait, so they just conveniently found a centuries-old law to block the English king? That sounds like a post-hoc legal loophole. Was anyone actually buying this argument at the time?
This raises an important question about how medieval law was actually utilized. I mean, Salic law was not some immutable constitution set in stone. It was flexibly interpreted as a political tool to reject foreign pretenders.
So it was just a mechanism to keep the English out?
Exactly. The French nobility fully understood that if Edward III became king of France, the French crown would essentially be absorbed into the English monarchy. The center of power would shift to London.
Right, and the French lords were protecting their own localized power structures, their patronage networks, and preventing a foreign sovereign from dominating the French political landscape.
So they used this legal interpretation to bar Isabella from passing the claim to her son Edward. Instead, the French nobles crowned a cousin through the male line, Philip of Valois, who became King Philip VI.
And initially, Edward III accepted this reality. He actually traveled to France and performed homage to Philip VI in 1329. But the underlying friction remained, and it was primarily rooted in the southwest of France in a massive region called the Duchy of Aquitaine.
Also known as Gascony. Edward III held Aquitaine, but he held it as a vassal to the French king.
I think of this like a complex corporate merger where one CEO technically works for another CEO, but only in a subsidiary branch. Edward was a sovereign, anointed king in England, But the moment he stepped foot in Aquitaine, he was supposed to bow to Philip VI as his boss.
That is a great way to look at it. And the dispute hinged on the specific type of homage required. Philip VI demanded liege homage.
Which meant what, exactly?
Liege homage meant full, unquestioning subjection. It meant Edward would have to provide military service to Philip, and it gave the French king the legal right to confiscate the duchy if Edward disobeyed.
And Edward naturally wanted to give simple homage, which was more of a polite, diplomatic acknowledgement of overlordship that kept his sovereign dignity intact and limited French interference.
Right. But this wasn't just about royal pride, though. The economic stakes in Aquitaine were massive. Gascony exported up to 20,000 tons of wine to England every single year.
And a ton is a massive cask, right, holding over 250 gallons.
Yeah, it was a massive volume of trade. The English crown relied heavily on the customs taxes from that wine trade to fund its government.
And then we must factor in the other economic engine of the era, Flanders, located in modern-day Belgium. Flanders was the industrial powerhouse of medieval Europe, famous for its massive cloth manufacturing industry.
But their looms required English wool. Over 80% of England's wool exports went directly to Flanders. The English rural economy was deeply dependent on the Flemish urban weavers.
So when Philip VI tried to exert more direct French royal control over Flanders, he threatened to sever the English economic lifeline.
Exactly. And the sources also detail how these monarchs were funding their early posturing, which brings up the debasement of coinage.
Right, because if a medieval king needs to raise an army quickly, he generally has to ask a parliament or an assembly of nobles for permission to levy a tax. But there is a backdoor method, isn't there?
Yes, there is. The debasement of the currency. Both the English and French crowns heavily manipulated their coinage to fund the early stages of this conflict.
How does that actually work mechanically?
Well, a monarch would recall the silver coins currently in circulation, melt them down, and remint them by mixing in cheaper base metals, like copper.
Okay.
They would then issue the new, impure coins with the exact same face value.
So the king essentially steals a percentage of the silver from his entire economy to pay his soldiers.
Precisely. But the immediate consequence of debasement is rampant inflation. Merchants quickly realize the coins are worth less in inherent silver weight, so they raise their prices.
So this economic instability driven by the wool trade friction, the wine exports, and massive inflation, it created a highly volatile environment.
It did. You have this severe economic tension, combined with the subsidiary CEO dynamic in Aquitaine and the lingering insult of the French crown. That tension over paper claims, homage, and trade routes inevitably spilled onto the battlefield.
And the breaking point arrived in May 1337, leading us into the first major phase of the conflict, often called the Edwardian War.
On May 24, 1337, Philip VI officially confiscated the Duchy of Aquitaine. He claimed Edward had breached his feudal duties by sheltering a French fugitive named Robert of Artois.
And Edward III responded not by apologizing or negotiating, but by reviving his claim to the French throne in its entirety and declaring war.
The English needed to cross the Channel safely to fight this war, which leads directly to the Battle of Sluys in 1340. The French had gathered a massive fleet of over 200 ships to block the English from ever landing on the continent.
The French admirals, Hugh Curet and Nicolas Beauchet, they anchored their fleet in the Zouain estuary off the coast of Flanders, right?
Yes. And they took their 200 ships and lashed them together with heavy iron chains, creating a massive floating wooden wall across the bay.
I mean, that seems tactically rigid. You are on the ocean where mobility is your primary advantage, and you chain your ships together. You've basically built a static wooden island.
It was a very strange decision. The English approached with around 150 ships. Because the French ships were chained together and completely immobile, the English essentially approached this naval engagement as if it were a land battle that just happened to be floating on water.
That is exactly how it unfolded. The English ships, packed with thousands of longbowmen, sailed in on the incoming tide. They had the wind and the sun at their backs.
And they just rained a continuous volley of arrows down on the tightly packed French decks before grappling the ships and sending heavily armored men-at-arms aboard.
The battle lasted from dawn until dusk. Because the French could not maneuver, break formation, or escape the arrow fire, it became a methodical slaughter.
The sources report 15,000 French sailors were killed. It completely wiped out French naval power for years. sleuths gave England total control of the English Channel.
And that control allowed Edward III to launch a massive invasion into northern France in 1346, culminating in the Battle of Crécy.
Crécy is a defining moment in military history. It's where the fundamental rules of engagement shifted. In August 1346, Edward III's army of 10,000 to 15,000 men was intercepted by a massive French force commanded by Philip VI, numbering between 27,000 and 40,000 troops.
So the English were heavily outnumbered. They set up a defensive position on a low ridge near the village of Crécy. And this is where we have to detail the mechanics of the English longbow, because you really cannot understand this era without understanding how this specific weapon completely dictated the outcome of these battles.
You really can. The longbow was typically carved from a single piece of yew wood, standing about 6 feet tall, and the construction is vital. The bowyer used the sapwood on the back of the bow, which handles tension well, and the heartwood on the belly, which handles compression.
Right, and it had an immense draw weight, ranging from 160 to 180 pounds.
Pulling that string back to the ear required incredible physical strength and a lifetime of skeletal conditioning. Skeletons of English archers from this era actually show physical deformities, enlarged arm bones, and bone spurs from the sheer stress of pulling these weapons.
That is a staggering detail. So a skilled English archer could fire 10 to 20 arrows per minute. When you have thousands of archers, that effectively creates a blinding, continuous storm of steel and wood.
Exactly. And environmental factors played a critical role at Crécy. Before the battle began, a severe thunderstorm rolled through. The rain soaked the field, turning the freshly plowed dirt into slick mud.
And that rain had a massive impact on the weaponry, because the French employed about 6,000 Genoese mercenary crossbowmen.
Yes, and a crossbow relies on mechanical tension. The rain soaked the strings of the French crossbows, causing them to slacken and lose their power.
But the English longbowmen, seeing the rain, simply unstrung their bows and tucked the strings under their helmet to keep them dry until the storm passed.
It was a simple but vital adaptation. When the French ordered the Genoese forward to open the battle, their weapons were highly ineffective. Their range was severely reduced.
The English stepped up, restrung their bows, and unleashed an absolute torrent of arrows. The Genoese, taking massive casualties without being able to return fire effectively, panicked, turned, and fled.
And Philip VI, enraged by the sight of his mercenaries retreating, ordered his heavy cavalry, the elite, armored French knights, to charge right through their own fleeing infantry.
Wait, really? He ordered his nobles to trample his own men?
He did. It was complete chaos. The French knights charged up a muddy slope, their heavily armored horses tripping in potholes and slipping in the muck.
And all the while, the English longbowmen positioned on the flanks were firing bodkin arrows. These arrows featured a narrow, chisel-like point designed specifically to punch through the rings of chainmail.
Right, and they aimed for the unarmored lower bodies of the horses. The French charges, up to 15 separate disjointed waves of them, collapsed into a tangled, bloody heap of screaming men and dying horses.
The French lost over 10,000 men that day, including 1,500 to 2,000 high-ranking nobles.
While the English losses were minimal, numbering in the hundreds, the superiority of the aristocratic armored knight on horseback had been completely shattered by disciplined peasant infantry and massed archery.
Following that decisive victory, Edward marched north and laid siege to the highly fortified port city of Calais, starting an 11-month blockade from 1346 to 1347.
The siege of Calais was a brutal war of attrition. The English didn't just surround the city, they built an entire wooden camp town outside the walls, complete with a marketplace, to sustain their army through the freezing winter.
Yeah, they blockaded the port with their navy, slowly, methodically starving the French garrison and the civilian population inside.
By the summer of 1347, the people of Calais were eating horses, dogs, cats, and rats. Finally, facing total starvation, they surrendered.
And Edward III was furious about the massive amount of time and royal treasure the siege had cost him. He demanded that six prominent citizens, the burghers of Calais, walk out with nooses around their necks, carrying the keys to the city. He fully intended to execute them as an example.
But Edward's pregnant wife, Queen Philippa, threw herself at his feet and pleaded for their lives. She argued that executing these men who had surrendered would anger God and be a terrible omen for her unborn child.
So Edward relented, sparing the men. Calais became an English stronghold, giving them a vital strategic foothold and a heavily defended trading port on the continent for over two centuries.
The English dominance continued 10 years later at the Battle of Poitiers in 1356. Edward's son, knows the Black Prince, led a devastating raid, a chevauché, through western France. He was eventually cornered by the new French king, John II.
Let's break down the mechanics of a chevauché, because this isn't an army marching to conquer a city and hold it. This is a highly mobile column of soldiers moving rapidly through the countryside with the explicit purpose of destroying the economic foundation of the enemy.
Right. They burn the wheat fields, they slaughter the livestock, they burn the villages, and they even smash the millstones so the peasants cannot grind whatever grain is left.
The goal was to prove that the French king could not protect his own people, thereby breaking the feudal contract. But the Black Prince's column, weighed down by massive amounts of looted wagons, was caught by King John II.
Once again, the French had superior numbers, and once again they faced an English army in a strong defensive position. Learning from the disaster at Crécy, the French knights actually dismounted to attack on foot, hoping to avoid the slaughter of their horses.
But the Black Prince utilized the terrain perfectly. He hid his forces behind thick hedgerows and vineyards. He used a feigned retreat, pulling his men back slightly to make the French think the English were breaking, to lure the French infantry forward into a trap.
And once the French committed, the English archers fired at point-blank range, and the prince flanked the French line with a hidden cavalry reserve.
The tactical brilliance resulted in a catastrophic defeat for France. Not only did they lose thousands of men, but the English actually captured King John II on the battlefield.
Which is just a massive geopolitical earthquake. Capturing the anointed king of France led directly to the Treaty of Brittany in 1360. France was forced to agree to massive territorial cessions, essentially handing over a third of their country in the southwest to sovereign English control.
Furthermore, they had to pay a ransom of 3 million gold crowns to get King John back.
3 million gold crowns was an unfathomable sum. It equated to several years of total royal revenue and effectively bankrupted the French state apparatus.
Okay. Let's unpack this dynamic. We have Crécy and Poitiers, two massive battles where the English longbow completely decimated the French army. If the technology was so undeniably dominant, why didn't the French simply copy it?
That is a very common question. Why not take a year, hand out longbows to the French peasantry, and train them to fight the English on equal terms?
Exactly. Why not?
The answer lies entirely in the social and political structure of medieval society. The longbow, as we discussed, required a lifetime of training to master. In England, royal edicts mandated archery practice every Sunday for the yeoman class. But French armies were fundamentally built around the social supremacy of the armored knight.
Because the nobility held all the political and military power.
Right. So deliberately arming the massive French peasantry with weapons capable of easily penetrating the armor of the nobility was a terrifying prospect for the French elite.
I see. Adopting a peasant weapon en masse directly threatened the very foundation of the feudal hierarchy. The French nobles feared a heavily armed peasant uprising far more than they feared the English army.
And as it turns out, their fear of a collapsing society was justified. Because while the English dominated the battlefield with their archery, an invisible force swept through Europe that cared nothing for grounds, treaties, or longbows. You cannot burn down the agricultural base of a country for a decade and not expect biological consequences.
Right, the plague. Between 1347 and 1351, the bubonic plague, known as the Black Death, arrived via trade routes from Central Asia.
The demographic collapse is staggering to comprehend. The sources indicate that 30 to 60% of the entire European population died in the matter of a few years.
It was an apocalyptic event. And the mechanics of the war and the mechanics of the plague worked in a horrific synergy, didn't they?
They did. Armies moving constantly across the continent, alongside the massive merchant convoys supplying them, acted as rapid super spreaders for the fleas carrying the Yersinia pestis bacteria.
And this connects directly back to those English chevauchés. By intentionally burning thousands of acres of crops and slaughtering the livestock to destroy the French economy, they created severe, widespread malnutrition among the surviving peasantry.
Exactly. A starving population with heavily compromised immune systems is infinitely more susceptible to a bacterial plague. The war fed the plague by providing vectors and weakened victims.
And the plague deeply complicated the war by devastating the manpower needed to fill the armies and farm the land. The strategy of the chevauchés feels like burning down an entire neighborhood just to evict a single tenant. It is incredibly destructive, and it caused massive social upheavals.
Yes, the crushing tax burdens required to fund the armies, combined with the extreme labor shortages caused by the plague, sparked massive violent uprisings.
In France, the peasantry was breaking under the weight of taxes needed to pay King John II's massive 3 million crown ransom.
And in 1358, this tension erupted into Jacquerie. Peasants violently targeted the nobility, burning manors, destroying tax records, and killing lords.
The peasants felt the nobles had failed in their primary, sacred, feudal duty to protect the realm after the utter humiliation at Poitiers.
The French nobles, terrified by this inversion of the social order, ruthlessly crushed the Jacquerie within weeks, slaughtering thousands of peasants.
But England wasn't immune to this unrest either. In 1381, they faced their own massive insurrection, the Peasants' Revolt.
The English government, struggling to fund the ongoing, highly expensive campaigns on the continent, instituted a highly regressive poll tax. It was a flat tax of 12 pence per adult, regardless of their income or wealth.
To a wealthy merchant, 12 pence is nothing. To a peasant laborer, it is a crushing, impossible sum.
Right. This triggered a massive march on London, led by a man named Wat Tyler. The rebels actually breached the Tower of London. They executed the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Royal Treasurer.
The revolt only ended when Wat Tyler was killed during a chaotic meeting with the young King Richard II at Smithfield. But looking at the broader economic data in the sources, did this demographic collapse actually empower the surviving peasants given the severe labor shortages?
If we connect the plague to the broader macroeconomic picture, the historiographical debate is quite nuanced. In England, the surviving yeomen and peasants absolutely saw their negotiating power rise.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Manorial records from the period show wage increases of 20 to 40%. Because half the workforce was dead, the labor of the survivors was suddenly incredibly scarce.
So a peasant could simply leave a harsh lord and find another lord willing to pay better wages or offer lower rents.
Exactly. But it was a vastly different story in France.
How so?
Well, in France, the physical devastation of the war, the burned fields, the destroyed infrastructure was happening on their soil. Following the violent suppression of the Jacquerie, the French peasantry often faced heightened rather than reduced exactions.
Because the state desperately needed funds to rebuild walls and defend against English raids.
Yes, and they extracted those funds forcefully through heavy direct taxes.
This overwhelming chaos of plague, economic ruin, and rebellion forced a major shift in French strategic thinking during the Caroline phase of the war. They finally moved away from those disastrous chivalric charges to a grueling, pragmatic war of attrition.
Charles V, appropriately known as Charles the Wise, took the French throne in 1364. He analyzed the defeats at Crécy and Poitiers and understood that fighting pitched battles against the English longbowmen was essentially suicidal.
Right, it was just throwing men away.
Exactly. So he appointed a minor Breton knight, Bertrand du Guesclin, as his constable of France.
Du Guesclin is a fascinating figure. He was not your typical aristocratic knight looking for battlefield glory and ransom. He implemented a strict, highly disciplined strategy of guerrilla warfare. But how do you wage guerrilla war in the 14th century?
By aggressively avoiding the enemy's main force. He outright refused to engage large English armies in the open. Instead, he harassed their long logistical supply lines, ambushed their foraging parties so the English soldiers starved, and conducted night raids. If he wanted to take a castle, he didn't launch a massive siege. He used bribery, subversion, or night escalades.
Meaning climbing the walls in the dark.
Precisely. And it worked brilliantly. By 1380, Charles V and Du Guesclin had systematically reclaimed nearly all the massive territorial gains the English had secured in the Treaty of Bretigny,
leaving the English with little more than Calais and a few isolated coastal enclaves.
While France was methodically recovering its territory, England descended into deep domestic turmoil. The young King Richard II faced persistent, bitter conflicts with his parliament and his powerful nobles over the staggering costs of the failing war effort.
And his increasingly autocratic rule ultimately led to his deposition by his cousin, Henry Bolingbroke, who took the throne as Henry IV in 1399.
Henry IV spent almost his entire reign fighting simply to legitimize his usurpation. He had to deal with the powerful Percy family rebellions in the north and a massive, protracted, highly effective uprising in Wales led by Owain Glyndwr. England was entirely distracted by internal survival.
Under normal circumstances, France would have capitalized on England's distraction to push them entirely into the sea. But France suffered a catastrophic crisis of its own. The literal, clinical insanity of their king.
Charles VI ascended to the throne at age 11. But in 1392, he suffered a severe psychotic episode that changed the course of European history.
What happened exactly?
He was riding through the forests of Le Mans with his army when a man rushed out and warned him of betrayal. Charles was suddenly gripped by intense paranoia. He drew his sword and attacked his own retinue, slaying four of his own knights before he could be physically wrestled from his horse and subdued.
And it wasn't a one-time isolated event triggered by stress. His delusions continued for decades.
They did. The sources describe periods where he completely forgot his own name, didn't recognize his wife, the queen, and most famously had periods where he believed his body was made entirely of glass.
He had iron rods sewn into his clothing to prevent himself from shattering and refused to let anyone touch him.
With the absolute monarch completely incapacitated, a vicious, predatory power struggle erupted between his relatives to control the levers of government. Primarily his brother Louis, Duke of Orléans, and his cousin John the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy.
That political tension turned bloody in 1407 when Burgundian agents ambushed and assassinated Louis of Orléans in the streets of Paris, hacking his hand off in the process.
This brazen murder fractured France into two warring factions, the Armagnacs, who supported the royal family, and the Burgundians. It paralyzed the French state.
How does a medieval state function at all when the king believes he is made of glass and the royal dukes are assassinating each other in the streets?
It forces a profound evolution in governance. Because the physical body of the king was broken, the French had to rely heavily on administrative regency councils to manage the day-to-day operations of the realm.
So during this period, the abstract concept of the state began to separate from the physical person of the monarch.
Exactly. The bureaucratic machinery, the royal courts, the tax collectors, the local magistrates kept functioning out of sheer necessity. However, while the tax collectors still worked, the lack of central executive leadership meant that military defense completely collapsed. The resulting Armagnac-Burgundian Civil War left France uniquely, dangerously vulnerable.
And that vulnerability was being closely monitored across the channel by an ambitious, highly capable new English king, Henry V. He was ready to exploit the divided French realm, leading us into the Lancastrian zenith.
Henry V succeeded his father in 1413. Unburdened by the immediate rebellions that had plagued his father's reign, he looked across the channel, saw the Armagnacs and Burgundians slaughtering each other, and decided the timing was perfect to renew the English claim to the French throne.
So in August 1415, Henry sailed from England with an army of around 11,000 to 12,000 men. He landed in Normandy and laid siege to the port city of Harfleur.
The siege of Harfleur was eventually successful, but it took much longer than Henry anticipated. And it came at a terrible biological cost.
Right, because they were camped in marshlands during the late summer heat, and a massive outbreak of dysentery ravaged the English camp.
Yeah, by the time Harfleur surrendered in late September, Henry's effective fighting force was heavily depleted. It was reduced to somewhere between 6,000 and 9,000 sick, exhausted men.
It is late in the campaigning season at this point. Winter is approaching. A conservative commander would have garrisoned Harfleur and sailed home to wait for spring.
Instead, Henry decides to march his depleted sick army across northern France toward the safety of the English stronghold of Calais.
It was a massive strategic gamble. He wanted to demonstrate that he could march through French territory with impunity.
And the French took the bait. A large French army, numbering between 12,000 and 36,000 troops, moved to block his path, intercepting the English near the village of Agincourt, on October 24th.
So the Battle of Agincourt happens on October 25th, 1415. We opened with a glimpse of this, but we really need to break down exactly what happened mechanically, because the tactical details here explain the sheer horror of medieval warfare.
Definitely. Heavy rain had fallen throughout the entire night before the battle. The battlefield was a freshly plowed agricultural field situated precisely between two thick woods.
And the heavy rain turned the churned-up dirt of that field into a thick, sticky, knee-deep mud.
Henry V arrays his exhausted men. He places his heavily armored men-at-arms in the center and positions his longbowmen on the flanks. Crucially, anticipating a cavalry charge, he orders his archers to drive sharpened wooden stakes into the ground in front of them, angled outward toward the enemy.
The French commanders, overly confident in their massive numerical superiority and eager for the personal glory and ransom of capturing the English king, ordered an advance.
But the terrain, the woods on either side, funneled their massive numbers into a narrow front. As the heavily armored French knights charged, the thick mud sucked at their boots and horses' hooves, slowing their terrifying momentum to a grueling crawl.
The English longbowmen unleashed their volleys. Now, armor technology had advanced since Corneille's. The arrows couldn't easily pierce the heavy sloped plate armor that the French knights now wore on their chests.
True, but the arrows still decimated the unarmored lower bodies of the horses and struck the knights in the weaker joints of their armor.
The French vanguard was thrown into total disarray. Wounded horses bucked and threw their riders into the deep mud, but the true horror came from behind, didn't it?
Yes. The successive waves of French troops, eager to get into the fight, kept pressing forward from the rear, entirely unaware of the carnage and the stalled advance of the front lines.
It created a horrific, fatal crowd crush. Think of the physics of a modern concert crowd crush, but applied to men wearing 60 pounds of steel armor.
The men at the front were packed so tightly they couldn't physically lift their arms to swing their weapons or even breathe. Hundreds, perhaps thousands, simply suffocated or drowned in the mud inside their own visored helmets as they were trampled by their own men.
Once the arrows finally ran out, the lightly armored English archers, unburdened by heavy plate, dropped their bows. They picked up mallets, lead-weighted axes, and daggers, and waded directly into the mud.
They easily maneuvered around the exhausted, bogged-down, immobile French knights and slaughtered them methodically at close range.
The numbers from the sources are chilling. The English lost a few hundred men, the French lost up to 10,000 men, and an estimated 40% of the entire French nobility perished in the mud at Agincourt. Entire aristocratic bloodlines were wiped out in a single afternoon.
It was a catastrophic decapitation of the French political and military leadership. Henry V returned to England a conquering hero, parading through London. But he didn't stop there. He returned to France in 1417, not to conduct a raid, but to systematically conquer and occupy the Duchy of Normandy.
This wasn't a chevauché. This was a modern war of territorial occupation and siegecraft. He laid siege to Rouen, the heavily fortified capital of Normandy, from 1418 to 1419.
The siege of Rouen demonstrated Henry's absolute cold-blooded ruthlessness. He completely encircled the city with 35,000 troops, cutting off all supply lines.
And as the food ran out and the city began to starve, the French garrison made a desperate decision. They expelled 12,000 non-combatants, women, children, the sick, and the elderly, hoping Henry would observe the rules of chivalry and let them pass through his siege lines to safety.
Henry utterly refused. He forced those 12,000 civilians to remain trapped in the ditch between the city walls and the English trenches. The French garrison wouldn't let them back in, and the English wouldn't let them out.
They slowly starved and froze to death in the winter cold, eating grass and weeds. Rouen eventually surrendered, securing complete English control over Normandy.
Henry's unstoppable military dominance, combined with the bitter ongoing hatred between the French factions, culminated in the Treaty of Troyes in 1420.
The geopolitics here are fascinating. The Duke of Burgundy, Philip the Good, mediated this treaty. He was furious that the Armagnac faction, who were aligned with the French Dauphin, the heir to the French throne, had assassinated his father.
So, seeking revenge, Philip allied his massive Burgundian resources with Henry V. Together, they dictated terms to the mentally incapacitated Charles VI.
The Treaty of Troyes was a legal masterstroke for the English. It formally and legally disinherited the Dauphin Charles, declaring him a bastard. It declared Henry V the regent of France and, critically, the legitimate, undisputed heir to the French throne upon Charles VI's death.
To seal the deal and legitimize the bloodline, Henry married Catherine of Valois, the daughter of Charles VI. Henry achieved what Edward III had only dreamed of decades earlier, a legally binding, internationally recognized document making him King of France in waiting.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. It was the absolute zenith of English success in the war. But the foundation of this triumph was incredibly fragile. The entire legal validity of the treaty relied entirely on the young, vigorous Henry V outliving the old, sick Charles VI.
And fate intervened in the most abrupt way possible. In 1422, while campaigning in France, Henry V contracted dysentery, the exact same disease that ravaged his army at Harfleur, and died at the age of 35.
And just weeks later, the elderly Charles VI finally died.
This bizarre twist of timing left Henry V's son, Henry VI, as the legally recognized king of both England and France.
But Henry VI was a 9-month-old infant. He obviously could not rule.
Right. The English had to rule their vast continental holdings through a regency council headed by Henry V's brother, the Duke of Bedford. While Bedford was a highly capable administrator and commander, the relentless English momentum was beginning to stall.
The English seemed to have a permanent stranglehold on the continent, but the momentum was about to violently swing back to the French, led by the most unlikely military commander in European history.
By 1428, English forces had advanced deep into central France to the Loire Valley and laid siege to the highly strategic city of Orléans. If Orléans fell, the rest of southern France, which remained stubbornly loyal to the disinherited Dauphin Charles, would be wide open to an English invasion.
It was the last major defensive bulwark. And out of this desperate, apocalyptic situation emerges Joan of Arc.
In 1429, this teenage peasant girl from the village of Domrémy arrives at the Dauphin's court in Chinon. She claims she has had vivid divine visions from saints instructing her to lift the siege of Orléans and see the Dauphin officially crowned king.
In a state of near total political and military desperation, Charles grants her an audience. Against all logic of medieval hierarchy, she somehow convinces him of the authenticity of her divine mission.
He equips her with white armor, a banner, and sends her with a relief force to Orléans.
Her arrival completely transforms the tactical and psychological dynamic of the war. She didn't rely on cautious maneuvering. Within days of her arrival in late April 1429, she coordinates aggressive frontal assaults on the heavily fortified English bastions ringing the city.
By May 8th, the seemingly impenetrable siege of Orléans is broken and lifted. She didn't stop to celebrate either. Joan immediately spearheaded the Loire campaign, aggressively pursuing the retreating English forces.
This rapid advance culminated in the Battle of Patay in June, where French forces completely routed the English army in the open field, capturing their most renowned and feared commander, John Talbot.
These shocking victories cleared the path to the city of Reims, which was deep in enemy territory but was the traditional sacred coronation site of French kings.
On July 17, 1429, the Dauphin was anointed and crowned Charles VII, with Joan standing by his side holding her banner.
It was a massive psychological victory. The coronation at Reims provided the undeniable ideological and religious legitimacy that Charles VII desperately needed, and it shattered the decades-long aura of English invincibility.
But Joan's story has a famously tragic end. She was captured by Burgundian forces during a minor skirmish outside Compiègne in 1430. They held her for ransom, but Charles VII did not intervene.
The Burgundians sold her to the English, who orchestrated a highly politicized heresy trial in Rouen. They needed to prove her visions were demonic to invalidate Charles's coronation. She was burned at the stake in 1431.
Joan's horrific execution did not stop the massive French momentum she had initiated. The diplomatic landscape fundamentally shifted 4 years later at the Congress of Arras in 1435.
Philip the Good, the Duke of Burgundy, looked at the changing tide of the war. He realized the English, ruled by a child king and struggling with finances, could no longer guarantee his territorial ambitions.
So, acting purely out of pragmatic self-interest, he abandoned the English alliance and officially reconciled with Charles VII.
The defection of Burgundy was a catastrophic death blow to the English cause. They lost massive amounts of logistical support, funding, and troop numbers in northern France. Without Burgundian support, the English hold on Paris and the surrounding regions quickly collapsed.
Charles VII then used this breathing room to completely restructure his military apparatus. In 1445, he issued ordinances that established the Compagnies d'Ordonnance. Let's dig into the mechanics of this, because it changes European history.
This is a monumental shift away from feudalism. Charles created 15 permanent companies of heavy cavalry, totaling around 9,000 men.
Instead of being called up for 40 days of feudal service and then going home for the harvest, these men were paid a regular fixed salary directly by the crown, both in times of war and in times of peace.
France had created the first professional standing army in Western Europe since the fall of the Roman Empire.
But how do you pay for a standing army? Medieval kings were notoriously broke.
You implement a permanent tax. Charles VII instituted the tail, a direct tax primarily levied on the peasantry. But the crucial mechanism here is that he managed to collect this tax without requiring the annual consent of the provincial assemblies or the Estates General.
This gave the French monarchy a massive, independent revenue stream. They didn't have to beg nobles for money anymore. This massively centralized royal power and laid the direct groundwork for the absolute monarchy of figures like Louis XIV centuries later.
And alongside this standing army, Charles VII invested heavily in the artillery revolution. Two brothers, Jean and Gaspard Biro, were appointed to modernize the French siege train and field artillery.
They didn't invent gunpowder, but they perfected its application. They standardized the sizes of the mobile cannons. They shifted from firing carved stone projectiles, which often shattered on impact, to dense iron cannonballs.
And crucially, they utilized corned gunpowder. Corn powder is processed into uniform granules, which allows oxygen to flow between the grains, making it burn much faster and with significantly more explosive force than the fine powder used previously.
The devastating effectiveness of this new military machine was demonstrated at the Battle of Formigna in 1450, where French field artillery actively disrupted the English longbow formations, forcing them out of their defensive positions and leading to a decisive French victory and the rapid reconquest of Normandy.
And it all culminated at the Battle of Castillon on July 17, 1453. The English, desperately trying to hold on to their last territories, sent an expeditionary force to Gascony under the command of the veteran John Talbot.
Talbot, perhaps underestimating the massive advancements in French technology, ordered a rapid frontal assault on what he thought was a vulnerable French encampment.
But inside that entrenched encampment, Jean Bureau had meticulously deployed 300 modern field guns.
The French artillery decimated the advancing Anglo-Gascon troops before they could even reach the lines. They fired hundreds of rounds of iron and lead balls, ripping through the dense English formations. The era of the longbow was definitively over.
Talbot himself was killed when his horse was struck by a cannonball and pinned him to the ground, where he was killed by a French archer.
Following the absolute slaughter at Castillon, the French laid siege to Bordeaux, the heart of the English wine trade, which finally fell in October 1453. England lost all of its massive continental possessions, keeping only the isolated port of Calais.
Which effectively ended the conflict on the continent.
I have to ask about the military reality here, comparing the sources. When we look at Joan of Arc's religious fervor versus the structural changes, like the standing army and the corn gunpowder cannons, was Joan a genuine tactical genius who won the war, or was she just a massive necessary morale boost that bought the French state the time it needed to implement these sweeping reforms?
Synthesizing the evidence from the period reveals a dual reality. Joan of Arc absolutely provided the critical psychological turning point. She broke the English momentum and provided the profound ideological legitimacy Charles VII desperately needed.
But tactically.
However, her tactics were often blunt frontal assaults that relied on religious zeal rather than strategic maneuvering. It was the geopolitical defection of Burgundy, the professionalization of the military through the Compagnie d'Ordonnance, and the deployment of massed standardized field artillery by the Bureau brothers that definitively provided the material, physical means to expel the English and win the conflict.
With the English expelled and the cannons cooling, the fighting effectively ended without a formal peace treaty. But the societies left behind in both countries were fundamentally, permanently transformed, bringing us to the broader legacy of this 116-year conflict.
The most profound shift was in the mechanics of state building, specifically regarding how logistics and taxation were handled. In England, the indenture system completely replaced the old reliance on feudal levies. The crown would draw up a contract and indenture with a private captain to raise and supply professional troops for a specific period.
It sounds
we also see the definitive, undeniable decline of chivalry as a military reality. The aristocratic armored knight, representing the elite nobility, was no longer the undisputed master of the battlefield. The war proved that massed peasant infantry with longbows, and later, commoners operating industrial gunpowder artillery, could annihilate the aristocratic heavy cavalry.
The social supremacy of the knight was broken by technology, which brings up a major historiographical debate found in the sources regarding nationalism. We often hear this war framed in pop history as a war between the English nation and the French nation.
We must dispel that myth entirely. This began purely as a dynastic dispute over feudal land rights, inheritance, and homage. The armies involved were highly multinational. English forces included massive contingents of Welsh longbowmen and Gascon infantry, while the French relied heavily on Bretons, Genoese mercenary crossbowmen, and fiercely loyal Scottish allies.
But the shared trauma of over a century of continuous warfare, the constant vilification of the enemy through royal propaganda, and the massive centralization of military power inadvertently laid the groundwork for modern state identities.
A peasant in 1450 was much more likely to identify as a subject of the French state than his great-grandfather in 1340, who likely only cared about his local feudal lord.
And we cannot ignore the immediate violent aftermath in England. The English nobles, returning home across the Channel permanently deprived of their wealthy continental lands, ransoms, and revenues, turned their highly militarized ambitions inward.
A kingdom full of unemployed, heavily armed nobles who are used to solving disputes with violence is a recipe for domestic disaster. This systemic tension contributed directly to the outbreak of the Wars of the Roses in 1455, a brutal, decades-long civil war between the houses of Lancaster and York for control of the English throne itself.
So what does this all mean? How should we view the Hundred Years' War today as a senseless medieval tragedy or the painful, necessary birth of the modern European state?
It was the fierce crucible that burned away the outdated feudal order. The sheer duration, the logistical complexity, and the staggering cost of the conflict demanded adaptations that localized medieval systems simply could not provide. It commodified military service, centralized state finances, spurred technological innovation, and reshaped European diplomacy around hard territorial boundaries rather than personal feudal oaths.
As we look at the political borders and administrative structures of modern Europe, we see the deep, lasting echoes of those 116 years of blood and mud. Before we wrap up this deep dive into the sources, consider this one final thought. The devastating English loss at the Battle of Castillon in 1453 might have been, ironically, the greatest long-term strategic victory for the British Isles.
Because it forced them to look elsewhere.
Exactly. By being permanently, violently ejected from the continent, England was forced to stop squandering its national wealth and manpower on endless, unwinnable European land wars. Instead, it was forced to turn its gaze outward, building ships instead of castles, looking to the sea, and inadvertently setting the stage for its future as an unprecedented global maritime power. Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.